Pope is the thing with feathers.
Pope is the thing with feathers.
That's like a bird.
Like a bird.
That perches in the soul.
That perches in the soul. Welcome to the Thing with Feathers podcast, a podcast about birds and hope. I'm your host, birding enthusiast, Courtney Ellis. Welcome back to the Thing with Feathers podcast. I'm your host, Courtney Ellis. Delighted to have with us today, Amy Tan, who is the author of many books, both fiction and nonfiction, including two children's books. She's written The Bonesetter's Daughter and The Joy Luck Club. In addition to her life as an author, she is also a passionate birder. Her new book, The Backyard Bird Chronicles, is newly released, and it is like nothing I've ever encountered. It is such a fabulous book. Amy, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
I loved The Backyard Bird Chronicles so much. It's such a unique mix of writing and journaling and drawing. I read so many books on birds and birding, and I've never encountered a book like this. What inspired it, and how did it come to be?
In 2016, I became distressed because there was a lot of overt racism, and I had never experienced it quite to that degree before, and it felt very depressing, and I knew it was so ugly. I needed to find beauty again in my life, and what better place than to go into nature? And so I started doing nature journaling, which includes drawing and making observations, writing those down, and as I learned to draw, I was just drawn to birds more. And I started to focus just on birds and in my backyard because I can't drive. So I couldn't go to different hot spots or anything like that. And it turns out my yard is a pretty good little hot spot. So I'm drawing this and making my notes. I never intended this to be a published book. This was a private journal, kind of like a spontaneous memoir, you know, no reflection for 10 years. This is like 10 seconds ago. And my editor was the one who thought maybe we could publish this. And I thought that wasn't possible. It was such a mess. And I'm not an expert on birds. And, you know, who am I to do this? I was, just learning to draw. So anyway, he said, let's do it. And the publishing house said, let's do it. And here we are.
It's so wondrous. And I love that you kept in some of the very rough sketches and the very rough journal articles. And you are a self-proclaimed recovering perfectionist. What was it like to send out such rough things into the world? Because so much of it is beautifully polished prose, but you also have some very rough sketches and observations. Was that terrifying? Was it freeing?
In a way, it was not as terrifying as it would be for me to show unfinished, unrevised work that is written, like for a novel. I would never show anything like that. But I was learning to draw, and I started posting this on the Nature Journal Club. And so I got used to people seeing it, and it was, they're all very encouraging. And I would, we'd all say, you know, what we loved about each other's observations. So it felt safe, and it was a good way. Even if I didn't like a drawing or a sketch, I would post it just because I needed to do that, to get over this idea everything had to be perfect. And that wasn't the point of it. Nature journaling is really about what you're observing and not creating something necessarily perfect or pretty.
Well, in the preface, you write that you started the book in 2016. And when you began, you could only identify three different birds in your yard. And today you recognize 63 and counting. What changed 66. For you? 66. I love it.
What? The last one was a great blue heron, which is completely out of its habitat. And I couldn't believe it, you know, to have a bird like that sitting on our roof, actually. And it's just surprising. It's proof, I think, that we only see things in a very limited way. And when we start paying attention and really sit down and taking the time to observe, we do see more. And as I said, I was a beginning birder. I really knew very little about species. I called the three birds well, there was a crow, and then there was a hummingbird. I didn't know it was an Anna's hummingbird. And there was a blue jay, which it turns out was actually a scrub jay because we don't have blue jays on the West Coast. Just saw a lovely blue jay here in Central Park just this morning. So eventually I started putting feeders together and I got more and more birds and I started counting these birds and being able to identify them in part because I was sketching them and I could put the colors down and then I could go looking for, gosh, this is some kind of sparrow. And then I'd look in on the app and I would find a sparrow that matched that. So I, you know, it was better than saying to you, this is a bird that has a yellow bib and it has a little mask here and it's got white flanks and streaking. I could draw it and then go to the app to find that bird. So sketching was really important in helping me to understand, to learn who these birds are, what they were doing.
Mm. You write that your impulse to observe birds comes from the same one that led you to become a fiction writer. By disposition, you write, I am an observer. How has this disposition influenced your birding?
It involves my becoming the bird. Now, I do that when I'm creating characters in fiction. In order to feel completely empathetic, it's at that level of, you know, crossing that barrier between who you are and trying to imagine that character and all the characteristics, all the beliefs, which may be quite different from mine, and then a different entity, a bird. But it was important to me to understand what birds were about and not look at these birds simply from a human perspective. So as much as I could, I would try to look at behavior and see what that was about. And I realized that almost all of it was related to survival. Mm. And when the bird is looking all around, they're looking at the sky, the little ones are looking up all the time. And except ironically, when they're bathing and completely vulnerable. But then the hawks would be looking down. You know, so I could see these things. Hawks need to eat. There's, you know, a great mortality rate in those early years. Same with songbirds. So a lot of it about food, understanding food resources, learning to fly, learning to be aware of danger, learning where to, you know, bunk for the night. And so I was trying to feel all of that as much as I could.
Hmm. At the beginning of the book, you describe hand feeding a hummingbird. And after drawing and describing the experience, you end with, my bird in the hand was gone in half a second. It was enough. I am in love. And it's capital letters and it's underlined.
Yeah. Yeah.
How would you describe that spark of affection and delight and joy that has come for you in coming to know the birds?
Well, it's unreal and it feels magical because who would imagine this, these hummingbirds that are so fast and so precious, and that it would be so unafraid, it would just land on my hand and look at me. I could even talk to it and say, oh gosh, you're so beautiful. You're, you know, and I would speak in a soft voice, but it didn't deter it. It stayed there and it looked at me. So that was magical. It was something I instantly became addicted to. And I've had a few other birds land on my hand almost inadvertently. I was putting food out once, and I guess I wasn't doing it fast enough. So the pygmy nuthatch landed and took the food I had in my hand. But it's the hummingbird who is really, truly the bravest of the in terms of interacting with humans. And the tinier the bird, it seems the less afraid they are. Isn't that strange? You know, you'd think it would be the big birds. The owl wasn't afraid of us, but all the other little songbirds definitely were very cautious.
Mm-hmm. I'm a West Coaster too, so I appreciated that so many of the birds you wrote about were in my own yard. It was wonderful to see my birds in your book.
Yeah.
I also appreciate that your book, it mirrors the act of birding itself and swinging from this joy, this delight, to some deep heartache. You mentioned pieces of the pandemic in the book, parts of the journal came out in, or were written in 2020, but also your delight in the hummingbird is followed immediately by your encounter with this sick pine siskin that's the very next entry. And at first you're intrigued, you go outside, the bird doesn't move, you're kind of excited, but then you realize it's ill. How do you navigate that grief?
Well, yeah, that was a heartbreak. You know, when people ask, what were your spark birds? I have to say the hummingbird, but the pine siskin in this ironic, sad way also was part of that. And I thought it was a baby bird. This is how naive I was because it was all fluffy. And then I realized, oh no, they don't breed in December and have babies in December. So then I saw its half-closed eyes, the diarrhea, and that it flew to me, which is really abnormal. And I knew it would die. I looked up salmonellosis, and that by time it was puffed out, that it would probably be dead within 24 hours. I took all the feeders down. I was so heartbroken that I thought I would never put the feeders back up. That was the idea of seeing a bird that I knew was going to die. Even though there were hundreds of them, you know, and everywhere. That was the year of... what is that called? You know, when you have a huge influx of migratory birds of one species.
Eruption.
Eruption, yes. It was an eruption year for pine siskins, which seems to happen every few years. And I just, even though it was just one out of this huge number, I was just devastated. But about 4 months later, I decided to put the feeders back up, and they came. I was very cautious at first. There were a few, one of the things that came out, when I say it's a spark bird, one of the things it sparked was my interest in conservation. Now, you can't, you know, do conservation with a pine siskin on your feeder, or some people say don't do feeders, but it was that the life of a bird, even a single bird, was so precious. The sanctity of that life was important. And I decided that I would go into conservation of birds. And I started doing some work with American Bird Conservancy, with Point Blue, with WildCare, and a number of other places, and eventually joined the board of American Bird Conservancy and have been learning a lot about what actually happens in conservation. So I had other times when there were sick birds that would land on the feeders. And as soon as I saw those, I took the feeders down. But what was funny, when I did that, I discovered that I had more birds in my yard than I thought. I'd never seen an orange-crowned warbler. Mm. When I took the feeders down, these birds came to the window and looked at me, the bathroom window. It was like, yoo-hoo, you know, we're here, we're eating, we're hungry, where's the food? There was also a white-throated sparrow, which I see occasionally, but I never knew it was there eating this food that time, and a purple finch, bird that I see that often. So they were all eating this food. I had no idea. So I always wait a while, and then I'm always cleaning these feeders, but I think these birds arrive sick, you know, and then I take them down and then I put them up later after 2 weeks, 4 weeks, whatever it is. For some of the things like salmonellosis, I would leave it down for a longer period. I've only had that once. But for, say, pox, you know, I will thoroughly do the feeders. I use hydrogen peroxide or accelerated hydrogen peroxide, and I can spray it on there on a daily basis. But it would often be the finches. And so what I did was I took the seed feeders down. The finches were gone within the day.
I love that your book captures what so many of us who are fairly new to birding find, that it quickly becomes an obsession. And you go to the store and now you're buying feeders, and now you're kind of a mealworm dealer for a point. You know, your fridge is full of these mealworms. And it's the same rigor with which you approach your writing and other things in your life. Do you enjoy that obsessive quality of birding, or?
I do. I've always been obsessive about interests. You know, fiction is an obsession. I got into dogs for a while, and that was an obsession. I got into show dogs. I actually co-owned a dog that became the number one Yorkshire Terrier in the country, number one stud dog. Used to go to all the dog shows, Westminster, and the little local shows. So that obsession is gone. I don't think I'll ever lose my obsession with looking at birds in my yard. For one thing, I don't have to go to a dog show and eat hot dogs for lunch. And they're so fascinating being wild. And anyway, the obsession does extend to always feeling like there's a better food out there for these birds. And I would buy live mealworms. At first it would be 3,000, then 5,000. And it was during nesting season. And I started to see that these birds were coming every 30 seconds. And I thought, that's not the same bird, is it? And then I realized it's probably parents taking turns, going back and forth. And pretty soon I was going through 1,000 mealworms a day. So then I started buying 10,000, then 20,000, and then a new refrigerator, and on and on and on. I will say my husband is very understanding. He's never complained about the live mealworms in the fridge except once, and that was when I was doing the 20,000. There was almost no room in the fridge for anything else. And I've also kept dead birds in the freezer, and he hasn't complained about that either. The dead birds, unfortunately, about once a year, I did have some window collisions that were fatal. And also people would bring me dead birds, and then I would take them to California Academy of Science and give them to the ornithologists there. But most of us who have active bird feeders, if we have windows, that's something that might be experienced by all. And it's devastating. Every time it happens, I get sick to my stomach. But I did do something about that. I bought acrylic pens, white ink acrylic pens, and I drew spider webs all over my window. So it's covered, you know, every 2 inches, there's no space. And I do see birds about to fly into the window, and then it's literally like they put on the brakes. It's like, you know, and they see it. So it works. Yeah.
DIY bird strike.
My husband hasn't complained about that either. You know, you take view windows of the bay and the islands and you cover up your windows with spider webs. That's not what most people would do. But when you're obsessive about birds, you know, it's like being obsessed with your child. Nothing is too, you know, good for your birds.
Sounds like you married well.
Yes, yes. We've been together 50 years. So
50 years.
Yeah.
Do you have a favorite bird? I know that's like asking people if they have a favorite child or a favorite book that they've written all their books.
I have favorite birds in different periods. I really, of course, love the hummingbirds because they are big, big personalities. And I can call them and they come. And their remarks to me and their little, you know, language, it seems like they kind of disapprove of me. but then they kind of know that I'm okay. They will do some aggressive moves and circle around my head with really loud beating wings. So I know that's like giving me fair warning. But I love that big personality and a little body. I love the little oak titmouse. He's very funny. He's so bossy. And he has that little crest that goes up and down. He's trying to be so assertive. But I've had little baby ones come into the house. They're on the feeder. I open all these. I have windows on almost all sides of the house. They're 12 by 8 feet tall on one side and about 30 feet by 8 feet on another side. So these windows would be, window doors would be open all the way, all this. So it's like an airy, you know, they can come in and out. The little oak titmice fledglings went into the house. They didn't crash, fortunately, but they got to the end and they're like, whoa, how do we get out of here? And I would go up to it and it's looking at me. Its mouth is open. It's breathing hard. And its tail, its crest is completely down. And its feathers are actually very floppy. And I guess that is true of young birds. That they're, these are, you know, low-class feathers. These feathers are going to be replaced. I shouldn't call them low-class. They're you know, they're temporary feathers that are not as refined as the final feathers that they would have as a juvenile or adult, you know. So they were really floppy, like bent. And then I'd pick up these birds and I'd say, don't come in here again. Mm-hmm. And then I'd let them go. And then I'd see them in the feeder. 5 seconds later, I just would look at them and point my finger and say, don't you dare come in here. You know? Yeah, I mean, so that's a favorite. California towhee is a favorite because he's just so funny and jolly and hopping across. And usually his mate or her mate is with, you know, they're together. The great horned owl. We had great horned owls from July, two of them, a mother and a son, from July until October one year. And then in October, the mother left. I was told by a friend who's a bird guide, the mother would probably leave in October, and she did. And then the young one stayed until April. Hmm. And then, so every day, imagine this, you wake up and you say to your husband, is Junior here? And then, yep. And then you go and you first thing in the morning, you look at the two owls there and all's right in the world. Unfortunately, Junior did bring his girlfriend over for a while. And then I guess they were ready to nest and they left. We had no suitable nest that they would be able to take over. No hawk or squirrel nest that they could commandeer. So I think they're local and near somewhere in the neighborhood. And I'm hoping they bring their young to our tree to learn hunting lessons, which is what the mother did when she brought the owl to our, you know, our trees. I could be at the dining room table and look up and there the owls would be. That's how close they were. Mm. Kind of scared me with the dogs. I have a 4-pound dog. But it turned out when they're sleeping in the day, they don't hunt. Hmm. And they're preening or they're sleeping. Hmm. And I know that because one time there was a squirrel on a hot day that spluted in front of them, just completely vulnerable. And all the owl had to do was reach over and grab that squirrel. And it did circle its head, looked at it, and then just said no and closed its eyes, went back to sleep. So they don't hunt during the day, as far as I know. Certainly not one that, not, you know, maybe they hunt if they have nestlings, but I didn't have to worry about the dogs anymore.
Have you faced any temptation to fill the yard with rodents, like you fill the fridge with mealworms, just to keep the owls close?
We had such a rodent problem. We had rats that ran across our patio, and you know, you can't use poison or just horrible things like glue traps. So what do you do? And you can't even, these humane traps, if you take a rat to an unknown environment without its social structure, they'll die of exposure, starvation, whatever. And so it's terrible death too. What could we do? Well, I just had to keep the feeder area really clean. I got something that would hold the seeds that the finches would throw, used to be on the ground. And so there would be no food for those rats. There would still be rats that would come, you know, three or four. And And then the owls moved in. And pretty soon there were fewer rats and then none. I could leave food out in the open. I could sprinkle seeds on the ground and there would be no rats. That's how effective owls are in getting rid of your rat problem. And of course, I did worry that they were going around the neighborhood and some of the neighbors would have put poison out. The owls are still around, so they're doing well.
Do you ever name the birds?
The only bird that I named were Junior and his mom, the owls, but that was because there were two of them and they were there day and we needed to differentiate them. So it would have otherwise been the lighter owl or darker one or the bigger one and the smaller one. So we just called them Mom, who was bigger than Junior and also was lighter colored.
So on this podcast, we talk about birds and we also talk about hope with a little nod toward Emily Dickinson and The Thing with Feathers.
I love that song. Yeah, I love that.
It's in the public domain, so we can borrow it now. When you think about hope and define that as you will, where are you finding hope these days?
I find it a lot in young people who are, they are the ones who are going to carry forth legacies that we have. They are the ones who are going to be stewards in the future. And when I meet young people who are very conscious of doing good in the world, of doing that kind of conservation and being mindful, then they are the hope. And I know of friends who've raised their kids to be, concerned about the rest of the world, that it's not about getting the most money, and earning this and having privileges. So they give me hope. I love it when kids love nature. I have my goddaughter lives next door and she has two children, 12 and 6. And we do nature things together. I gave them binoculars or go to an event on raptors. And we went and found owl pellets and dissected them. And they will find feathers and they'll say, here's the owl feather. And of course I say, you can take care of it. You can't keep it or do anything with it. I tell them you're not allowed to do these things and take them. So they understand that, but it's still great for them to find bits and pieces of things and be excited. And so that gives me hope that they're going to continue into the future. Anytime I see a demonstration of kindness, then I take hope from that. There's a lot that, it tests that hope. And I just have to have hope that most people want to do good. Most people ultimately are kind and compassionate and will be good stewards of our earth.
Final question. You write about the fact that birds help you not feel cooped up staying at home, which I think so many folks got into birding during the pandemic because it's one thing we could do. We could look out our windows. We could go in the yard. We could go to the park next door. You write that so much remains new. So much can be discovered. When watching birds, I feel free. And birding has such a low bar to entry. You can bird if you're young. You can bird if you're old. You can bird if you have mobility issues. What would you say to someone who maybe can't get out very much and they think, I can't be a birder because I can't get to the marsh. I can't get to the park. All I have is my window and my yard. What would you say to that person?
You can still bird. You can watch birds. You can find one bird and just follow that bird with your, observe that bird day after day. And if you do that, you'll see that the bird does some really interesting things. You're not just seeing one bird, you're seeing a bird do conduct its life. And some people will say, I can't have bird feeders because our condo association doesn't allow it, our apartment doesn't allow it, our yard, it'll attract rats. And I say to them, you can get a shallow bowl and fill it with water, put a little rock in it so they know how deep it is, just 1 inch, 1.5 inches of water. Change it every day, scrub it, you know, and make sure there's no algae on it. But that's all you need. Put that bowl out and you will see if you do that every single day reliably, that after a month or two, or maybe after a day or two, you would get birds and they will come regularly because they need to bathe and drink every day.
Mm. It's so simple. And
it's simple. You can attract them and then you can see they become your bird the minute they look you in the eye. And I guarantee you, every bird is aware of you and where you are, even when you think you're far enough away that they can't see you. They do see you. And then when they look directly at you, you'll fall in love. And then you'll want to see that bird every day. And then you never feel cooped up. You never feel like it's the same day, day after day after day. It's always new.
It's beautiful. Your new book. Everyone, check out Amy's new book, The Backyard Burned Chronicles by Amy Tan. It's coming out and it is so spectacular. And congrats on the release and the launch.
Thank you.
The Thing with Feathers is produced by me, Courtney Ellis. Many thanks to Del Belcher for the music, to Todd Peterson for the name inspiration, and to Emily Dickinson for the beautiful poem and for being in the public domain. Until next time, my friends, keep looking up.
What does it go in your soul?
Yes, it does.